You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show, fresh warnings from both Moscow and Kiev as Russia holds military drills on the Ukrainian border.
If our interests have been attacked, I don't see any other way but to respond in full accordance with international law. Russian citizens being attacked is an attack against the Russian Federation.
Ferocious words from Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov there. Also ahead, a series of meaty topics today. In addition to Ukraine, Daniela Peled and John Owen will be here to discuss the Hamas-Fatah Accord and North Korean fashion faux pas. Then we discuss airport design as T2 opens at Heathrow. Our transport editor will join me in the studio to talk about who airports are designed for and will complain bitterly about airport buses to boot. All that, plus we check in with our woman in Bamako and we take a look at the latest books to hit the shelves too. That's Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So lots to pack into the next hour here on Midori House, but before that, let's get the latest world news from James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Ukrainian forces have killed up to five pro-Moscow rebels as they close in on the separatists' military stronghold in the east. In response, Russia has launched army drills near the border, raising fears its troops may invade. Under an international accord signed in Geneva last week, illegal armed groups in Ukraine, including the rebels occupying about a dozen public buildings in the largely Russian-speaking east, are supposed to disarm and go home. But they've shown few signs of doing so, and today the Ukrainian Interior Ministry said its forces backed by the army had removed three checkpoints manned by armed groups in the separatist-controlled city of Slavyansk. The International Monetary Fund says its board will meet on April the 30th to consider an aid package for Ukraine. In a statement, the IMF said that Kiev had supplied the needed documents for it to determine whether conditions for a bailout had been met. The IMF tentatively agreed in late March to provide a multi-billion two-year bailout to help Ukraine recover from months of political and economic turmoil. The board has yet to approve the package. Three Americans have been killed after a security guard opened fire at a specialist hospital in the Afghan capital Kabul. The attack occurred in the grounds of the Cure Hospital, which specializes in children's medicine and is located in the west of the city. In other developments, the Afghanistan presidential election is poised to go to a runoff. That's after the latest tally of votes showed neither former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah nor former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani securing an outright majority. The Independent Election Commission said preliminary results based on 82.6% of the vote from the 34 provinces showed Abdullah in the lead with 43.8%, followed by Ghani with 32.9%. Abdullah spoke to reporters earlier.
There is a delay of 1 or 2 days, which we are not convinced why this has happened. And the numbers which are shown today, it creates a little bit of doubts whether it is a calculated pickup of sites and numbers in order to keep the results as it is, or it's really the reflection of what's there.
A presidential spokesman in South Sudan says the government is to free four high-profile political prisoners facing treason charges, the action meeting a demand by rebels in a faltering peace process. President Salva Kiir has come under mounting pressure as rebel fighters loyal to Kiir's sacked deputy Riek Machar seize territory and close in on northern oil fields that provide the country's economic lifeline. A rebel group in eastern Libya that controls several oil ports says it will not reopen the key Ras Lanuf and Es Sider terminals unless the government implements its part of a recent deal to end the oil blockade. In a sign of further delays to restart vital oil exports from the volatile east, rebels said the Tripoli government had failed to fulfill its part of the accord reached this month. On the anniversary of the collapse of a Bangladeshi factory last year, demonstrators in Paris and Brussels have called on companies to compensate victims and change their production practices. The tragedy at the Rana Plaza factory killed more than 1,100 people and left more than 2,000 injured. A complaint was lodged against French retailer Auchan by various associations over its alleged involvement in Rana Plaza. Vanessa Gauthier is head of mission for Dignity at Work at Peuple Solidaire.
Today we are suing Auchan for misleading commercial practices, which is the only way for us to put pressure on them. But obviously it's not sufficient, and transnational companies should be made accountable for what they do in producing countries like Bangladesh.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. James will be back at the bottom of the hour with a quick roundup of what's going on in the world. In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment for a digest of today's top stories.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London,
Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
So let's take on the top stories of today at 6 minutes past the hour. Joining me now to sink our teeth into the news is Daniela Pellet from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and John Owen, Chairman of the Frontline Club and Professor of International Journalism at City University. A warm welcome to you both. Do make yourselves comfortable. Let's begin with our top story, the continuing crisis in eastern Ukraine. In a moment, we'll talk about how Putin is controlling the message with the media. No great surprise there. But to bring us up to date with the day's events is Phil Hahn.
Forces loyal to Kiev have launched a series of daring anti-terror operations in the east of the country in a bid to retake a series of key cities. Earlier in the day, Ukrainian troops recaptured the town of Mariupol. Up to five pro-Russian rebels were killed, marking a serious escalation in the conflict. Ukrainian forces initially began an assault on Slovyansk, but because of a heightened risk of a Russian counteroffensive, the operation was paused.
If our interests, legitimate interests, the interests of Russians, have been attacked directly, like they were in South Ossetia, for example, I don't see any other way but to respond in full accordance with international law. Russian citizens being attacked is an attack against the Russian Federation.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov there. Russia also announced new military exercises along the border with Ukraine. President Obama accusing the Kremlin for their role.
We continue to see militias and armed men taking over buildings, harassing folks who are disagreeing with them.
Kiev is currently recalculating their options, according to an official close to the operation. Their next move could prove pivotal. For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
So to discuss this further, John Owen, Chairman of the Frontline Club and Professor of International Journalism at City University. Let's assess today's events. We've just got some breaking news that Simon Ostrovsky, the American journalist who was captured by pro-Russians yesterday, has now been released. He was ostensibly being held hostage. But this is now, this seems like it's entering another phase of rhetoric being delivered by Sergei Lavrov with real bite. And then Kiev and Russia and Moscow really getting closer and closer and closer.
Indeed, the rhetoric is escalating, and it's also the terminology is interesting, you know, how groups are labeled. I noticed I was watching Russia Today and also watching other channels. Are they rebels? Are they separatists? What are they? So, I mean, I think anybody listening to all of this has to kind of work out very carefully the terminology. Yes, and Obama was, I was watching MSNBC and CNN this morning, and they were definitely saying Obama's rhetoric is getting harder and tougher. He's talking more deliberately about some kind of, some toughening of sanctions. There's even a piece in the Foreign Policy newsletter that I get saying, and maybe it's time to revisit putting those defensive missiles in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Czech. It's time, you know, to do something. So things are getting a little tricky.
The rhetoric is there, but just looking at some of the reports that are coming from correspondents on the ground. We were talking to Tim Judah last week here on Monocle 24, and they were saying that in actual fact, yes, there are pockets of rapid events of violence, but there is also a sort of an almost parallel Ukraine which is continuing going about its daily life. And you've reported extensively from the likes of Gaza, Daniela, so you're quite adept at spotting the difference between everyday life and crisis happening on the same street. Is there often that risk of confusing things, especially by the media?
Well, I think definitely, you know, the media, especially if you have a narrow focus, you can reflect events which aren't indicative of what's happening to a large extent. However, today I spoke to somebody in Kiev who was telling me, and this really surprised me, that she and her friends are really feeling on a war footing, that people are keeping their cars full of petrol, they're packing emergency bags, they're not making plans to travel very far away, which to me is a sign of a worrying escalation, because from what I've heard from people up to now, especially in Kiev, you know, normal life has been going on. So I think it's a sign of just how scared people are getting, because the escalation is real, definitely. The rhetoric, and not just the rhetoric. I mean, the pro-Russian forces are getting much more aggressive. And I think we all know that the next steps could be virtual doomsday scenario.
Well, I was, and to reinforce your point, I was watching Barnaby Phillips on Al Jazeera, and he was quite shaken. Obviously, he had been led to see the body of a young activist who had been badly, brutally murdered and tortured, someone who was had a very key position in Slavyansk. And it was a terrible killing, and there was a huge amount of tension going on. So on the ground, the reporters are seeing very, very blatant examples of the kind of potential even further bloodshed that might happen.
And also, I think the kidnapping of this journalist, I mean, others have been taken and released. I mean, he was held for a bit longer. That signals a signal. You know, he was taken because apparently his reporting was biased. I think that was the message. You know, when you start doing this is in itself another escalation.
When you're watching this on the news, I think there has been some assessment of the media. It's when the media navel gazes quite excessively, but Russian media very much adopting the traditional approach. The shots of the pro-Russians are all warm, welcoming, waving St George's flags today, by all accounts. The Ukrainians are all masked, and there is this genuine fear of a fascist takeover on the cards for Ukraine. To what degree, though, and this is really pushing it a tiny bit, to what degree is there a sort of a nationalist rhetoric which Russia is almost desperate to put forward to its own people, given the fact that it's enjoyed Sochi and there has been a great amount of nationalist warmth? And this is just taking it to a degree that is beyond anybody's imagination a few weeks ago.
Sochi. Oh, that seems such a long time ago. We were talking about Russian soft power in this very studio. Again, as a conflict, it's very easy to frame whichever way you want, because the Ukrainian forces and the pro-Russian forces look equally sinister. If you have a sort of narrow lens on them, similarly from some of the, as we were saying earlier, if you put a narrow focus on some of the occupations of government buildings and so on, this looks like an immense crisis. But certainly the Russian media is transmitting things in a very, very narrow view, but not just to people in Russia. These are to Russian-speaking people everywhere. Certainly in eastern Ukraine, where Russian cable TV was part of the general packages, had a very strong reach, especially because its production values, I have to say, usually quite good. I think people in Ukraine have become a lot more media savvy very fast over the last 6 months. But certainly Russian media is a huge influence there.
Huge influence. But are they pushing, are they actually endorsing something which many have been arguing is little more than a historic return to the motherland?
Well, they're certainly triggering distant memories and old history. And obviously the terrible things that happened in the Nazi battles with the Soviet Union. I mean, there are terrible memories being brought back, and they're pandering to that, and they're inducing that with the kind of flag waving and historical footage they're showing. So yeah, they are manipulating people to a great deal, and it's worrying. And, you know, it's worth looking at your own new monocle here, by the way. There's a very good piece by Steve Bloomfield on Russia Today.
Russia Today.
And he actually gets to that. He speaks to the people putting on the program and questions, you know, what it is they're showing to the Russian people about what's going on.
Let's move on. Let's leave the crisis in Ukraine now and turn our attention to President Obama's tour of Asia. He's been pivoting to the Far East. It appears like he's been pivoting for years. It's about 3 years since he said he was pivoting. He's on his way to South Korea right now. Early in the day, he was in Tokyo. He met the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And there, the president reiterated his support with Japan over the disputed Senkaku Islands.
The treaty between the United States and Japan preceded my birth. So obviously this isn't a red line that I'm drawing. It is the standard interpretation over multiple administrations of the terms of the alliance, which is that territories under the administration of Japan are covered under the treaty. There's no shift in position. There's no red line that's been drawn. We're simply applying the treaty.
Okay, so who wants to kick off on this? Because this has certainly made Beijing smart. You're coughing, John.
I mean, really, here we go. 8 uninhabited islands and rocks, you know, in the East China
That's
Sea.
The principle of the thing.
Total area of about 7 square kilometers. I mean, you know, this is, again, clashing views of history. You know, the Chinese, they were our islands before they became their islands, and those are oil lanes, and those are very important fishing lanes, and, you know, everything is tied up in who controls that piece of water, but it's got huge symbolic importance now.
I think it's been quite useful, really, for Obama as a way he can make this symbolic move of supporting China's opponents on these issues without antagonizing China too much, because the pivot that you're talking about, I think Obama wants to avoid the same effect as the Russia reset, as a previous foreign policy adventure. He needs to calibrate his relations with China, which is a huge challenge, without antagonizing them too much and keeping commercial ties open and functioning.
This is perhaps not the way to go about doing this, though, that obviously the United States' support of Russia's claim on the Senkakus was demonstrated last year when the planes were flown over the Senkakus. To actually have it plainly spoken, and to, again, we're talking rhetoric again, it is someone staking a very, very public claim here. I wondered why Obama wanted to come out now when pretty much it was kind of agreed anyway that this was the way that United States operated.
I guess he's sending a message to Japan as well. I mean, the tone of his visit has been awfully chummy. He really has been meeting dog robots and eating the best sushi in the world and on first name terms with the leadership. You know, it's been all about reassuring that our ties are warm, our ties are friendly. And I think he's got a slightly different objective in each of the countries he's going to be visiting.
Well, you know, I was surprised, actually, when someone pointed out he's the first American president to be in Japan since Bill Clinton in 1996. And the other important thing is there is a very high-profile ambassador by the name of Kennedy in Japan.
Who was at the sushi restaurant last night.
Who was at the sushi. So that's another reason probably why he's there.
It's funny, though. I mean, this is Obama's first state. This is a first state visit by a president. I think Obama's been to Japan a couple of times before. But one wonders why he's deciding to antagonize China when, at the moment, China is being seen as the way forward in appeasing the other warring group in that area, which is South and North Korea. China was being heralded before Obama set off as being the people who could talk to Pyongyang and say, please don't carry out your fourth nuclear test, on President Obama's arrival. It perplexed me as to what his timing was like.
I would put this, point taken, but I think I'd put it in the context of American domestic politics, too. He is being hammered so regularly that he's not tough enough, that he's not taking forceful positions. This is, to support what you said, this is a kind of easy way to take a forceful position that he knows is not really going to alienate China, does reinforce his support for Japan and harden up his position at home. The same thing with Ukraine. He's got to do something short of actually committing troops anywhere. He's got to escalate his rhetoric, keep the Fox people, the MSNBC people, off his back a bit. So, and when you watch American cable television, you just realize how much of what's being talked about is the politics of what he's doing as opposed to policy or substantial changes in policy. So he's got to appear to be doing something.
In talking about substantial or the policy of what he's doing, what seems to have been slightly waylaid is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Apparently there is arguing about agricultural issues at the moment. All this was supposed to have been sorted out quite a while ago. To what degree do you think the recent events of Obama's trip to Japan have overtaken what many people were seeing as an opportunity for this pivot, economic pivot, to be gripped properly?
I think all the officials and all the diplomats surrounding this have been very much playing down expectations of any major progress. I mean, as you say, the sticking points are agriculture and automobiles, which for America, two quite big deals, really. So I think we're quite a long way away from this strategy, which is going to be crucial to the pivot. But as you've said, the pivot has been pivoting, you know, good 3 years now.
You wanted to say
something? The other thing he's probably talking about is how to avoid what one analyst calls the sadomonetarism, you know, to try to not go through the Japan period in which interest rates kept creeping up and they went into that terrible economic period. So he's probably having a very good conversation, too, with the Prime Minister about that.
We're going to take a short break now. John Owen and Daniela Pellet will be staying in the studio with me. In a moment, we'll discuss what little hopes there are for the Middle East and North Korean fashion.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
It's 18:22 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Daniela Pellet from the Institute of War and Peace reporting here in London and John Owen from the Frontline Club. Let's discuss now the latest developments out of Palestine. Fatah and Hamas have agreed on a landmark accord. They've put aside 7 years of disagreement and violence. The deal will pave the way for elections later in the year and hopes of a unity government. Unsurprisingly, Israel has voiced its anger and earlier today saying they were suspending all peace negotiations with the Palestinians. You were just saying before we came back on air, Daniela, we're back to square one again.
Well, it's the perennial story, Israel-Palestine, Israel-Palestine, Israel-Palestine. I think, just as we were discussing earlier, though, this is all about internal and domestic politics on both sides. I think we think that really the conflict is between Israel and Palestine, but a lot of what both governments or both administrations get up to really is regarding domestic issues. Gaza, ruled by Hamas, has been really cut off from the world, cut off from the West Bank for the last few years. And Hamas's grip there is waning. It's much less popular. There's an awful economic crisis, not just because of the Israeli closure, but more because the Egyptian government have closed the thousands of tunnels, which were the basis for Gaza's economy and for Hamas as well, because they taxed all the imports. So Hamas need to do something. One of the major demands for people in Gaza saying they want Palestinian unity. And that's what, in response to the Arab Spring, there were protests in Gaza and in the West Bank saying we want, never mind, the occupation is one thing, but we want our factions to reconcile.
So together, John, does Palestine stand a fighting chance of getting what it wants in the world stage?
Well, to me, it says basically Abbas has given up on any agreement with Israel, almost accepting it's not going to happen, and now he slides into an arrangement with Hamas. So it makes him look at least that he is battling for his side against Israel with the intractable foe of Israel. So he loses in terms of he's tried to accommodate Israel. It didn't go anywhere. now he does the deal with Hamas. That seems to me to make some sense. And I just don't see any way forward in terms of the negotiations.
It's something that Benjamin Netanyahu said a little over an hour ago, actually, which is Abbas has done nothing and he's basically walking away from peace by walking into the arms of a group that wishes to do away with Israel. What would you say to that, Daniela?
I'm not sure that Abbas did that much for the peace talks because the peace talks weren't really going to achieve that much. I mean, my view of this, he's waiting for the UN General Assembly in September. He's looking to what the international institutions can do for recognition of Palestine. He's fighting a different battle now. It's not an armed struggle anymore. It's a battle for international legitimacy. And the EU and other international organisations have also supported Palestinian reconciliation. And by turning to Hamas, he's making the point very clearly, I have other options, Mr. Netanyahu. Also, you know, the Israelis can't have it both ways, because one view you hear a lot is, well, Abbas can't make peace for the Palestinian people because he doesn't represent them and he doesn't represent the Hamas support. He doesn't represent Gaza. And so now the argument is, well, he can't make peace because he does represent them. So either way, it doesn't quite work out.
But as you point out, Egypt's a big factor in this because obviously Hamas backed the wrong horse. they do not have a friend in Egypt now, so
they have very few friends.
They had the deal. What does Kerry do now? He's banked so much.
Kerry has already made it clear that he blames Israel. I mean, in astonishing comments, he said, "Poof, the peace process disappeared." Now, for the Secretary of State to make those kinds of comments are incredible. The peace process wasn't going anywhere. Now we have to wait and see what happens at the UN. If Palestine makes a bid for membership again and it comes to the Security Council and America doesn't use its veto, we will be looking at an extraordinary situation for Palestinian independence, on paper at least.
You mentioned a moment ago, John, that you thought that Abbas was walking away from the peace process by going towards Hamas. Would you perhaps argue that, in fact, Netanyahu is now looking for an excuse to say that all this is, as John Kerry said, poof, gone?
Well, I think they both have their own motives for their own domestic constituencies about how to position why it didn't work. I mean, Abbas can say, we gave everything, it didn't work, so we're accommodating Hamas, and we're going to govern better, you know, our territory. Well, Netanyahu said, as you point out, you know, I tried, I gave, they won't budge. And what are they doing now? They're basically, it's the deal with the devil. We'll never deal with them. They'll never recognize Israel. And I don't know. Again, I think John Kerry must wonder why all he put all those air miles on.
Not just John Kerry. Really. Yeah. Everyone's wondering.
Yeah.
He
put a huge effort. I mean, the criticism of Hillary Clinton was that she didn't devote enough time to this. And certainly John Kerry has.
Netanyahu wouldn't deal with her, though, would he?
No, not really.
But he'd deal with Kerry. This was the thing. This was the one thing that was going to make it. But I think even when he launched this great effort about 6 or 7 months ago, the same conversation was being had. Why are we bothering? At what point then does the United States administration just walk away and said, it's all yours, deal with it?
When it gets to the Security Council. If they don't use their veto, we have a de facto state of Palestine. And it can join numerous international institutions. Again, you know, Israel will not be defeated militarily. I mean, for all the rhetoric Hamas comes out with the other armed factions, no one really thinks this is going to happen. Where Israel can be defeated or where the Palestinians can gain traction is on the world stage, on the stage of public opinion, stage of international diplomacy. The Israelis, surprisingly though, Netanyahu not always that popular. Over this, I think he's on a sure thing. Fair enough. Hamas do not recognise Israel. They've been bitter and implacable enemies. The average Israeli is going to think, well, you know, I see Netanyahu's point on this one.
And also, he's got such a hard-line coalition. I mean, there's no way to budge any further than he did. So,
we have but a bare few minutes to talk, Daniela and John, about another issue very briefly. Let's turn our attention to North Korea. We were mentioning earlier nuclear tests, but let's talk about something possibly a little more lighthearted. What you can and cannot wear on the streets. Apparently, the country's notorious fashion police have been trawling the streets of Pyongyang. There is a strict dress code. No blue jeans, no short skirts, no hats. I think that's just for the girls. Above all else, nothing must look foreign. Right, I don't know who wants to kick off with this one. Daniela, the absence of the individual on the streets of a country, that's quite terrifying.
It's quite terrifying, but this is another perennial story, I think, that international media are fascinated with. We had this in, you know, Eastern Europe during communism, in Afghanistan. People remember the Leonardo DiCaprio haircuts, which were very popular at the time of Titanic under the Taliban. I think we're fascinated by this idea that the individual always wants to make their presence felt, and that, that not just female, but also male desire for fashion and to look a bit special is really, really universal.
John, as you're teaching your students, and what advice do you give them on dictatorial, sartorial reporting?
What I wonder is what they do in the privacy of their own little units, housing units. Maybe they put on fancy clothes. And
without
in
a
place.
Doubt.
So I wonder also, I mean, was anybody doing a Dennis Rodman when he was there, the NBA basketball player? I mean, I wonder.
The piercing parlors of Pyongyang,
yes,
working
yes.
overtime.
Now that's a title for a book.
Daniela Pellet, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. And thanks also to John Owen. You're joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our woman in Bamako in just a few moments' time. Tristan McAllister will be here to discuss airport terminal design, and we'll give you a pick or two from the must-read books from the week. But before that, with the time at 31 minutes past the hour, James has the latest news.
Ukrainian forces have killed up to five pro-Moscow rebels as they closed in on the separatists' military stronghold in the east. In response, Russia has launched army drills near the border, raising fears its troops would invade. Under an international accord signed in Geneva last week, illegal armed groups in Ukraine, including the rebels occupying about a dozen public buildings in the largely Russian-speaking east, are supposed to disarm and go home. The International Monetary Fund says its board will meet on April the 30th to consider an aid package for Ukraine. In a statement, the IMF said that Kiev had supplied the needed documents for it to determine whether conditions for a bailout had been met. Three Americans have been killed after a security guard opened fire at a specialist hospital in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The attack occurred in the grounds of the Cure Hospital, which specialises in children's medicine and is located in the west of the capital. A presidential spokesman in South Sudan says the government is to free four high-profile political prisoners facing treason charges. President Salva Kiir has come under pressure as rebel fighters loyal to his sacked deputy Riek Machar seize territory and close in on northern oil fields that provide the country's economic lifeline. And a rebel group in eastern Libya that controls several oil ports says it will not reopen the key Ras Lanuf and Es Sider terminals unless the government implements its part of a recent deal to end the oil blockade. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. James will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news. And then after that, stay tuned for The Urbanist. Your host, of course, for that, our editor, Andrew Tuck. But in the meantime, welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. This is Emma Nelson. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world. Today we head to West Africa. On the line from Mali is our woman in Bamako, Alex Duvel-Smith. Welcome as ever to the programme, Alex. You bring us news of hostages and the death of one taken by an Islamist group a while ago.
Yes, Gilberto Rodriguez Leal is believed to be dead. An Islamist group, Mujal, made the announcement a couple of days ago and had previously made a call to the French foreign ministry to say that Leal was dead. Dead because France is an enemy of Islamism in West Africa, as the group put it. The French authorities believe that claim of his death to be true. Leal was a 62-year-old who was taken in western Mali in November 2012 when he was driving a camper van through Mauritania and then Mali on the way to Togo with a cargo of toys and school materials for a charity, and very little was heard of him after that. Now, he is one of the last hostages to have been taken in Mali. The French intervention in January last year did scatter somewhat the hostage takers, though four Algerian diplomats are still being held, and one hostage from France remains, Serge Lazarevich, who was abducted with another hostage in November 2011, and actually the other hostage has since been found dead. So still a lot of questions over Leal's, how he died, where he was held, and even by whom he was held. It's always very, very, very vague. The hostages change hands and become sort of, you know, a fold between groups.
I mean, one must also question the wisdom of driving a campervan through Mali in November 2012 when the country was clearly extremely unsettled. But you mentioned there are several hostages who are currently either being held or who have lost their lives. Is there still a very real threat of being kidnapped in Mali, or has that subsided somewhat since the country has settled down a little?
Well, the answer is yes and no. Hostages are still being taken, but they're not necessarily Western hostages. For example, a couple of months ago, five Malian Red Cross workers were abducted on the road between Gao and Kidal, and they were released only last week. Four Algerian diplomats are still a hostage, but Leal was the last Westerner, if you like, to be taken hostage. That's partly because of the success of the French intervention, but also because of travel restrictions mean that the Westerners, white-skinned people, essentially are very careful in the north of Mali, and there is a presence, of course, of French troops and the United Nations force of MINUSMA.
Just build on that a little, if you may, Alex, in terms of this French military presence now. Obviously, there was a very high risk and high-profile military operation last January, but ever since that, François Hollande has been desperately trying to avoid mission creep and try to avoid the French being permanently stationed there. How is that working out?
Well, and also, France has taken an interest in the Central African Republic. So, as you rightly say, France has been sort of under pressure to scale down quite quickly. And the drawdown has gone from 4,500 troops a year ago in January to an estimated 1,500 in Mali now, with a much more regional anti-terror brief. That gap, however, is noticeable because MINUSMA, the 12,000-strong UN force, isn't 12,000 strong. It's only 6,600 strong and still struggling to gain the manpower and the enablers, the helicopters and the vehicles to be able to deploy properly in northern Mali. Northern Mali, which, you know, is the size of France and Germany put together, and is a territory known very well but by very few people, and known by, for example, the French and the Americans, thanks to drones and satellite imagery. But, of course, that has been drawn down as well, leaving MINUSMA rather short of resources and the Malian army still totally incapable, really, despite some European Union training of 2,000 troops, but certainly nothing like the capability to police these vast borders, thousands of kilometres long. It's still a very dangerous area, and at the same time we're seeing getting indications that rebel groups are reorganising themselves, splintering, making announcements of new leaderships, and it's very difficult at times to understand essentially who wants an independent northern Mali and who is willing to remain Malian with a degree of self-control, and who is Islamist and who is a bandit and who is interested in drug running. All of these are very, very blurred lines, and they make it very difficult for intelligence services and for military forces to know who's friend and who's foe.
Alex Avar-Smith, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, our woman in Mali. Up next, we discuss the future of airport design.
A new generation of stationery entrepreneurs are reviving the art of letter writing. Monocle Films travels to Prague, Vancouver, and London to visit three stationery shops who share a love of paper.
I was always fascinated by the fact like how many different forms the simple piece of paper can have. I like the space that opens up when you unfold a simple piece of paper or when you open the notebook, and no email can ever replace the feeling when you open your mailbox and you find the letter there.
A celluloid celebration of old school stationery shops, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Earlier this week, Monocle 24 had a first look at the new Terminal 2 at London's Heathrow Airport. It was so exciting. The new base for Star Alliance Airlines at Heathrow was a shimmering building clad in glass and steel. But how much has it reinvented or readdressed what an airport terminal should be and do? This follows similar terminal openings in places like Mumbai, St. Petersburg, and also later this summer we'll be having the long-delayed Hamad International Airport in Doha. That is a complete reinvention, a brand new airport. Right, to discuss this and the future of airport design, Tristan McAllister. We've seen the pictures of, at least of the baggage claim hall of Terminal 2, bereft of passengers at the moment. So how do we think this is going to work out?
Well, I don't know. We were just talking about this. It's sort of hard to tell how great an airport is, aside from how it looks, unless there are actually people in it, not only checking in for flights, but buying things, sitting down for meals, the sort of the holistic picture of an airport, as opposed to just, you know, there's maybe a nice sculpture in the lobby, but what else?
I mean, one of the selling points is that's being plugged very hard to the media is making use of intuitive wayfinding without signs. Now, that to me, just I just thought, my goodness, at what point did I ever find a sign obtrusive and a problem in an airport? I mean, it is the one thing that a human being holds on to, especially if you are travel weary, in a rush, lost, compromised, goodness knows what, in whatever vulnerable state that a passenger may find themselves being in an airport. Because it's where you almost lose a layer of skin as an airport sometimes. To not have a sign would make me rather upset.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think what my fear here is that what they may try to do is supplant signs with apps. You know, this is a big theme at airports. So just wayfinding applications so you can find your way around the airport that way. But beyond that, I think wayfinding is sort of part of the experience. I think there's some amazing wayfinding out there. You look at Amsterdam, the Schiphol Airport. You look at wayfinding in places like Hong Kong. You look at how people have done it around the world. And I think that's a big part of the design language of an airport. So why would you necessarily do away with it?
There's one of those issues there as well with Terminal 2 in particular, is that it was originally a Norman Foster project. And then BAA went to Ferrovial. And then it went all Spanish. I mean, when you suddenly have a gear change in the middle of a rebuild, of a redesign, how much does that suddenly water down any original ideas?
I think it could greatly. I mean, I think a vision is a vision is a vision. And when you take a big name architect, you bring them in, I think that's great. I think it's also a very expensive thing to do. It might be, in the end, a more cost-effective thing to really to go with something that's a little bit more practical instead of a big name. A big name draws people. It draws a lot of headlines. But I think, you know, that has to be a massive shift, because if you do, in theory, you know, you take a lead architect away and then you maybe change some of the other vendors and the engineers and then the materials, everything sort of has to be redone. And these timelines are very sensitive. There's a lot of money at stake when things get behind, when things change. And the airline industry is very vulnerable to all of these things.
It's also one of those ideas that when you have a big name behind a design, to what degree does that almost cause more problems for the airport than actually just having some neat, quiet, efficient airport designer to get on with the job?
I think what happens here, to answer your question, I think you're completely right. I think when we have to, when we have executive committees and we have boards deciding that they're going to use a celebrity to design an airport, and then moving on from that, they're going to basically use the airport as sort of the capstone on their career, which a lot of them do, it means egos get in the way. It means that, you know, the attention is drawn away from what's really most important, and I think it's utility, about getting people to where they need to be, about facilitating those people in times of transit. That's the challenge. And I see a lot of talk about big name sort of designers doing these things, but I don't really care so much about the cathedral. That's not what I'm looking for at airports.
It makes you wonder what exactly or who exactly the airport is designed for. Is it designed as, like you say, a cathedral of beautiful architecture? Is it designed for the business traveller who will get his or her eyes down and try and get to the gate as quickly as possible without touching the sides? Or is it one of those lovely symbols of a national identity or national pride, which is obviously when you start getting big name architects in? Or is it actually just something for a treat for the family who go away and actually want to enjoy the experience of travel? Or is it all three or four?
Well, I was at a conference recently in Zurich and with Airports Council International Europe. And one of the themes or sort of the threads that were running through the conversations was that we have to think about who the core consumer is, who the target audience is. And there's a debate over whether or not it is business travelers or it is that person or that family that uses a terminal once a year, maybe once every few years. Because I think in theory, the business traveler gets to the airport, tries to get through it as fast as possible, and probably goes to the premium lounge.
Who travel for a living, where do you just actually not really remember that you're in the airport because it was so slick and so good?
There's two that come to mind. First of all, Zurich, yeah, that I just had a tour of just a few weeks ago, and then also Vantaa in Helsinki. You come into a very nice, you come to an entry point. Granted, there's more than one at Zurich, but still they're very streamlined and they make a lot of sense. But you come into a point and then you get fairly well distributed throughout the airport from that point, as opposed to, you know, you have consolidated security screening, all of that. Instead of trying to figure out, I mean, going to the airport can be a chore at a lot of airports because you have to just figure out what terminal you need to get to just to get to your flight, as opposed to just going to the airport. So, you know, it's sort of like a coordinate within a coordinate, and that starts to get confusing, especially day of travel for, you know, people who don't do it that often. So I look at Zurich, I look at Vantaa. Obviously, they had some leeway in terms of doing it right. And I think that's the issue. Not only political will lined up, but property probably lined up to make those things happen. So it can't happen everywhere. But still, I think that there are those case studies that let us know that there are ways to do it right.
Mm. And instead of the sort of the add-on pandemonium of Charles de Gaulle, of the likes of Charles de Gaulle or what have you, which we were discussing before we came on air, you absolutely despise. I take it on as quite a good challenge. I think I try and play the game, where am I?
I only said it because I've missed a few flights there.
Haven't we all? But that's part of the fun, Tristan. Finally, there was one in our sort of pre-broadcast discussion. We were talking about the bugbears that airports still haven't got right. And the one for me is I've checked in. I have smoothly made transition from check-in to gate. I am ready, and then a bus arrives, or I'm tired off a flight and I'm parked on a tarmac about 400 miles away from my terminal, and a bus arrives. That for me is where the magic goes away.
It's inexcusable.
What's your sort of must fix for an airport?
Well,
design?
It's, you know, I guess I should step back from that a little bit, because if I'm getting off a flight in Mallorca, or I'm stopping, you know, getting off of a flight in Honolulu, I'm a little bit happier that I'm walking down onto the tarmac and getting onto a bus, because it's sort of nice to take in the scenery in the air. But
there is a bit of ta-da.
Yes,
to it, yeah,
exactly. But getting off of a transatlantic flight after 6 hours in the air, you're off a red eye. You have 300 of your closest friends with you, and you get onto a bus, and you have to be bused to the terminal. I think it's outrageous, and that is a fundamental design issue, capacity issue.
How do they fix it? They
fix it by basically, you know, building airport, thinking about it the right way from the beginning. And I'll give some of the airports a break. Heathrow was built a long time ago. JFK was built a long time ago. They could not have foreseen these things, but still, it's not convenient. And I will just say, I would rather get on a bus off of a flight, you know, say an A320, 140, 150 people, than do it with 300. It just makes a huge difference.
No, I'm being slightly short in stature. I always end up, well, with my face somewhere, I'd rather not. God, those horrible drop-down ceiling handles. Oh, God, my idea of hell. Transport editor Tristan McAllister, thank you very much for your wisdom. You're listening to Monocle 24. In a moment, we give you our picks of the best books out this week. But before that, time for a little bit of music. Here is There Is No Other Time by The Claxons. I feel was The Klaxons and There Is No Other Time. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson and the time here in London is just nudging 18:52. It is a Thursday. Well, it is where we are. So that can only mean one thing. It's time for our weekly book review. Today, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Cathy Ransom-Rick, Project Director at Quick Reads and the Associate Editor of The Bookseller. And we love this book. Welcome.
Hello.
The programme. You wanted to kick off with a debut novel, A Lady Called Robin Black and Life Drawing. What was it that struck you about this? Why have you brought it in?
Well, she did a collection of short stories several years ago called If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This. And it was so good that since then I've been desperately waiting for her novel. And unfortunately, quite often when you hold your breath for something, often it disappoints when it arrives, actually. But this, I just think it's wonderful. And I have a bit of a pet theory. I think this is the sort of book, I think if a man had written this book, the world would be throwing itself at it. So I think sometimes the novels written by women that cover domestic things go a little bit less noticed.
Why do you say that? Is it because of the domestic nature of the plot?
Yeah, I think so. I think we expect women to be able to nail the domestics. So whereas if a man writes half convincingly about a relationship, we all get very excited.
So the premise of the book, we've given it away slightly, that it is a domestic, but it's one of those situations that you know that it can only end one way, which is when you have a husband and wife or a couple,
yes,
moving away from an old situation into a new one.
That's right,
and
yes.
And then everything unravels.
It does, yes. So Augusta is our narrator and her husband is Owen, and she's it's also very interesting from the point of view of creativity because she is a painter and he's a writer, both very successful. They move to the country because she's had an affair and the idea is that they will try to mend their relationship there. And then they meet a neighbour, they get close to the neighbour, somebody else arrives and it all blows up. So it's a literary novel that turns into a thriller about halfway through, which is those are the sorts of novels that I do really like. And one of the things that I think is interesting about it is we know that the husband dies in the first sentence. It opens telling us that the husband is dead, but then manages to build this brilliant tension.
You wanted to read the
yes,
top
I thought
line.
I might just read the first bit. In the days leading up to my husband Owen's death, he visited Alison's house every afternoon. I would watch him trudge over the small snowy hill between our two properties, half the time away from me, half the time toward me, and I would wonder what he thought about as he went. Wonder, too, if Alison watched him from a window of her own, and whether the expression she saw on his face as he approached was very different from the one I saw as he came home.
How does this differentiate from other domestic novels? Because I must confess, this is just an immediate personal reaction. To have a lead character called Augusta, who's a painter, I'm not even going anywhere near that book. But you said that this is one of your reads of the year.
Yes, completely. I think it's the best novel I've read this year that's been published. I mean, I like all the bits about creativity. There's a lot in it about being both blocked and creative. It's very good on the idea of how creativity works in a marriage, you know, when both partners are supposed to be creating, how that plays out if one person's finding it easier than the other. The house they move into was built in 1918 and they start renovating it. And as the builders knock it down, they find that what the original builders used to insulate the house was newspapers. So she becomes curious about what's in the newspapers and irons the newspapers, and they're from 1918, so they're full of all this death of young soldiers in the war. It's the stuff like that, but again with this very convincing, propelling tension about what's happening in the relationship, who's going to arrive. And also, again, we know he's dead from the first line. Why does he die? Because for the rest of the novel, they seem to be, you know, trotting along quite nicely.
That book, of course, is called Life Drawing by Robin Black. Let's move on to The Book of You.
So this is a debut by Claire Kendall. It's a fairly straightforward thriller. There's a young woman called Clarissa who is selected. We meet her when she's being selected for jury service, and she's relieved by this because she thinks it means she can escape the attentions of one of her colleagues, Rafe, who's become increasingly sort of pressing. As it continues, we work out that no, she's not safe there, she's not safe anywhere. And I picked it out because I think it's this interesting thing of crime novels being used as vehicles to explore social issues. And we do realise as the novel progresses how little power I think women have in these situations. It's sort of a stalker situation, a one-night stand that derails. So it's a really powerful page-turner, but with this continual kind of like undercurrent of a social issue being explored.
Again, we have names Clarissa and Rafe. It doesn't really endear itself to me. After Augusta the painter, I'm just wondering what is happening happening to today's novelism?
Well, rape's a nasty piece of work.
What kind of cross-section of society are you looking at here? what are their backgrounds, and what is it that brings them together in such a chaotic way, or brings them together in the thriller element?
He's a lecturer, and that's one of the ways in which he manages to take advantage of her. But it's very powerful. It's very good on her sense of reality and what people and the way that people sometimes don't necessarily even tell the truth when they feel in a difficult situation.
Finally, let's squeeze in Diary of the Fool. This looks interesting.
So Michel, I think you pronounce it, Michel Laub, he's Brazilian. He's written 5 novels, and this is the first one to be translated into English by Harville Secker. I hope there are more. This is a tiny little book, sort of robust and delicate all at the same time. So our narrator, the fool referred to, is that one of the, when the narrator was 13, he sort of conspired in an accident that left a school friend badly damaged, and this continues to prey on him. But he's also very preoccupied with his father's descent into Alzheimer's and his grandfather who survived Auschwitz. And his grandfather wrote all these sort of notebooks, diaries, but they're not true. He didn't write about what really happened. He wrote about other things. So it's fascinating from the point of view of how we make our own stories and how we think about our stories, what they say about ourselves.
And all compacted into one tiny book, Michel Laub's Diary of the Fool. Cathy Ransom-Brick, lovely to have you in the studio. That was Cathy Ransom-Brick from The Bookseller. That's all we have time for today's Midori House, I'm afraid to say. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Daniela Pellid and John Owen, who joined me for the first half of today's programme. My thanks also to our producer, Phil Hahn, our researcher, Alexa Feminish, and Michaela Aitken, and to our studio manager, to Alex Funnell. Not at the helm tonight, it was Joel instead. Next up after the headlines brought to you is The Urbanist with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. Then at 2200 hours, tune in for the Monocle Daily. This show, Midori House, will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, and for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.